Right now, one of the week's big stories. Archbishop Mark Coleridge, the Catholic Archbishop at Brisbane, has been in Rome for the Vatican Synod on the family, and he's become something of an international celebrity. A 300-word-a-day blog has been picked up by keen journalists and Vatican watchers around the world. So, well, here's Noel to introduce with his new title, Archbishop Coleridge.
The blogging Bishop of Brisbane has allowed us in some ways to see a little bit inside the synod, whereas the media is normally locked out of these things. But in terms of the outcomes, I see Damien Thompson in The Spectator saying the Conservatives have won. I see Josh McElwee in an NCR saying, well, you know, we've got real reform. You were there. What's your overall view of what the outcome is?
Well, first of all, I don't think it helps to see it in terms of who won and who lost. I think that's a melodramatised account of a very complex process and tends to turn it into a kind of a political caucus, which it wasn't. That there is a political charge to the Synod is absolutely clear. But to say that it's only politics and therefore we've only got winners and losers, who got rolled and who didn't, I think reduces the whole event because, as I said on that blog at one point, there is something greater than Solomon at work in the Synod. And I think that was very clear at the Synod's end yesterday when the document was finally approved unanimously, though not without some controversy that was fairly predictable. When the final vote was taken, the last of the 94, there was a very long and heartfelt round of applause. And I think that the applause signalled many things. But at the heart of them was a sense that there was something more than Solomon, because there were times on this Synod journey when it didn't seem we could come to the point that we came to at the end of the Synod yesterday evening. But then the Pope got up at the end. We weren't sure whether he would speak because he'd given such a blockbuster of a speech last Saturday morning. We weren't sure whether he would back up and speak again at the end of the Synod as he did last year. But he did. And it was, again, a quite remarkable speech, the text of which is widely available. I started taking notes, but I thought, no, put the pen down and just listen to what he's saying. And as I listened to Pope Francis speak, I thought, this is the voice of Peter. Now, in the Acts of the Apostles in the New Testament, there's a famous story told of the first ever, you could say, Synod of Bishops or Council.
The Synod of Jerusalem.
That's it, yeah. And at the end of all this intense discussion, where there was immense controversy about what to do with the Gentiles, the non-Jews, Peter gets up and speaks the word that carries the day. Now, that was the kind of word I think Pope Francis spoke. It was, in one sense, very simple and clear. In another sense, it was very deep and complex.
Can I ask you about exactly that? Because in his closing address, which we've got translations of, it seems that he said, the Synod had laid bare the closed hearts which frequently hide even behind the Church's teachings or good intentions. Now, how are to interpret that? Is that about black-letter law versus mercy? How are to interpret that?
No, I don't think so. I think he's made no secret of the fact that he's against legalism. Well, again, he's not the first to say that. So hiding behind law or doctrine in order to, as it were, lay burdens on the shoulders of human beings, he's dead against that. But here again, he only echoes the voice of Jesus Christ. So that's the first thing. The other thing, he's dead against just saying over and over and over and over again what we've said many times before, which may be true, but which doesn't always communicate. I have to say it's a point that I've emphasised in the many interviews I've given through the Synod, that it's not a question of changing anything that is non-negotiable. I don't think that was ever going to happen, and any expectation that it might was unrealistic, was bound to be disappointed. But that doesn't mean to say we haven't got immense scope for new ways of speaking, new ways of outreach, new ways of acting. And I think that's what the Pope's all about. The phrase I've used is pastoral creativity. But one of the things that has troubled me occasionally through the Synod journey is that there's a kind of an all or nothing approach, that if you touch the slightest jot or tittle of the way we speak or the way we approach people pastorally, then somehow the whole edifice will come crumbling down around us. It's a kind of an apocalyptic view of things. And that's been very striking. It's either light or darkness, good versus evil, all or nothing. And I just don't think that's the way human life works. And it certainly doesn't work that way in areas like marriage and the family, which are incredibly complex in any culture.
Well, can I ask you about that cultural thing before we move on to the specific questions? Because a couple of times in your blog, you've spoken about Italian being used and not all the bishops speaking Italian. So there was already a language issue.
Oh, yeah, that was certainly an issue with the final document. It was issued only in Italian, which was a serious flaw in the process and should not be repeated.
But also in terms of just the bishops understanding each other, the Pope in his final address said, culture, it's been exposed to all the bishops here that we come from such different cultures that sometimes you don't even seem to be making sense to each other.
Absolutely. And at times we seem to be talking from different planets. Because in this area of marriage and the family, there are huge cultural modulations and issues which are burning issues in Australia or elsewhere in the Western world just aren't on the radar screen at all in other parts of the world. And that was abundantly clear both in the plenary sessions but even more so in the small groups. I was in a small group that had about 30 people, 18 nationalities, from all the various parts of the world. And there were times when I just thought, how can we ever forge any kind of common understanding, let alone agreement?
Over a billion Catholics, as it were.
Precisely. And how can we even speak the same language? We're speaking English with various accents, but we weren't speaking the same language from time to time. And that was, I think, a great frustration. I mean, I've said to a lot of people, this whole journey has been a most unusual combination of fascination and frustration. And a lot of the frustration for me was trying to shape a common understanding from all these different voices, all these different cultures. And at times wondering, how on earth does the Catholic Church hold together for 5 minutes? But then you go back into the plenary and you sit there and, again, you look around and it's here comes everybody. But up the front is the Pope. And the power of Peter, you know, of the Pope, to somehow weave the tapestry and make that common understanding not easy but possible, and even a common voice, not easy at all, but at least possible.
Can I give you an example? This is probably one of the strongest examples I noticed, but I noted one Coptic bishop, one of the Egyptian Catholic bishops, got up at one point, gay and lesbian issues. And in his speech, I was a bit confused at first because he was saying, we can't go easy on this sort of stuff. We can't have any changes because otherwise we'll have homosexuality happening between men and women in Egypt. And I had to sit back and think, what is he talking about? And then I realised what he was talking about. He thinks anything to do with gay and lesbian issues is sodomy. And that's what's in their culture, it seems.
Well, it was more complex than that as I came to think about it, because there's no question on issues such as homosexuality, the African bishops in general were, to Western ears, extremely hard line. And once or twice, I'd have to say, verging on the scandalous to Western ears. But what's the real issue for them? The real issue, and it's one that's been articulated by Pope Francis, is a kind of an ideological colonisation. Mm. And there's a whole historical background to this, that in fact, a lot of gay ideology is a Western concoction. And even elements of gay identity, some would claim, are a fairly recent Western concoction. What the Africans are concerned about, and I think not totally without reason, is this new form of ideological colonisation. And I think that was the underlying issue. Mm. What it did, however, I think occasionally it led to words both in the small groups and in the plenary assembly that were seriously regrettable and would be regarded as completely unacceptable in any Western context that I know. But you have to understand where the Africans are coming from. Mm. Western colonisation has been a very bitter and enduringly destructive thing for them. They know it, we know it, but they know it better than we do. And that's the background for some of the stuff that went on issues like homosexuality. It's about ideological colonisation. Now, the challenge for us is to respect that concern of theirs and yet not allow that concern to become some of the dark and potentially scandalous stuff that was uttered. So there's something comprehensible at the heart of it, but some of the formulations certainly are, in my view, listening to it with Western ears, just need to be rethought when and re-spoken.
When you say that again, I heard the Africans reportedly, and I think this is accurate, that the way they were talking about gay and lesbian issues was as if gay and lesbian issues were just a Western construct, and in fact what homosexuality is in Africa is like a tool of war to assault people, it was basically
well,
what they were
see,
saying.
Again, it's precisely the point, but what... What that homosexuality occurs in Africa, no one denies that, certainly not the African bishops. But it's configured differently. It has a different social meaning, as you yourself are saying. So what they are trying to say, I think, or were trying to say through the synod, not that this was not an issue that was discussed sort of, you know, every second day. It had a fairly modest profile.
Some bishops didn't get to it in their small groups, as I see.
Oh, no, but that's true. No, it wasn't a huge issue, and it's interesting that you start with it almost. That certainly wasn't the way of the synod. It was on the radar screen, but it was by no means right at the centre.
It was the cultural issue, I have to say, that struck me because of the wide difference in view between African and Westerners on that particular matter. And it's not, and I realise it's smaller, but let's say divorce. Could we go to there, for example?
Sure.
Because divorced and remarried couples is another media darling, and it's part of the media discussion.
Mm. And clearly it was a more important issue in this synod.
Communion for those people was under discussion. And you said at one point, I personally think it's just not in touch with reality to say there is no good in those relationships. And you got some reaction to that.
Well, of course I did, and I expected reaction. But you can say the most moderate things and still draw huge fire in these areas. And the sensitivities were so electric in on some of these issues. But the fact of the matter is, and I kept saying to people here, we have to be in touch with the facts, with the reality on the ground, if we want this synod not to be just, in some idealised sense, a doctrinal synod, standing, guard ferociously over the truth with a capital T, but if we want it to be a pastoral synod, and it was supposed to be that, in the end it turned out to be that, we have to get in touch with people's lives. In other words, the reality, the facts on the ground. So you can't inhabit some idealised, romanticised world. Let us look at the facts. Now, my experience as a pastor, quite a lot of years by now.
40, I think.
Which, the 40-something, yeah. but you can't say that everyone who is divorced and civilly remarried is in the same kind of situations.
Yep.
There are, in fact, second marriages that are disasters. But there are others where, in fact, there's stability. There's mutual care and concern and love. There are children who are cared for. So let's not engage in these broad generalisations. Another point that I made that drew a lot of flack, but I think it's true in terms of facts on the ground, is that you can't say that a stable, loving second marriage is adulterous in the same way as two people who hardly know each other skulking off to a hotel room for a wicked weekend. You might want to use the word adulterous of both relationships, but it's not adultery of the same kind. Mm. So that's what I mean by getting in touch with the reality. Indulging in these broad, sweeping generalisations does not put you in touch with the facts on the ground, and if you're not in touch with the facts on the ground, your approach cannot be pastoral.
Well, just to pursue that a little bit, the Jesuit journalist Tom Rees said he had been initially convinced that the opposition to allowing divorced and remarried Catholics to go to communion, unless they had an annulment, was so strong that the synod would not be able to do anything. It doesn't seem to have turned out that way. Yeah, it doesn't.
No, because in the end, the pastoral approach prevailed, and ideology didn't. There was very little support for what Cardinal Casper put forward about the so-called penitential path. It was very clear from early on that wasn't going to fly.
This would be like the Greek Orthodox pattern, in other words.
Although it's quite different in other ways, because the Orthodox approach is based upon a whole set of underpinnings and assumptions that we don't share. Anyway, that's another question. But even if it was clear that proposal wasn't going to fly, the bishops, most of the bishops, as pastors, were determined to explore something in the middle ground. In other words, it wasn't all or nothing. That if we said no to the penitential path that Cardinal Casper had proposed, and he got huge flack for that, but anyway, God bless him, he proposed it, The other alternative was to say, well, nothing's going to happen, nothing's going to move, it's all or nothing. Now, there was a strong resistance to that, and I was certainly one who resisted, that we had to say, okay, that's not going to happen, but is there anything we can say or anything we might do that might give some hope to people in this situation, realistic hope, not pie in the sky? And I think, in fact, in the final document, which I think now has been published in English, I hope.
I haven't seen it yet, but I hope it has.
Well, the Pope said at the very end, it's going to be published and the voting will be published with it. But the drafters of that final document, I think, really did a masterly job in stitching together a set of words which mightn't have pleased absolutely everybody, but which did, in fact, rise from that very sensible, deep, pastoral middle ground.
Well, for the divorced or remarried Catholic, divorced and remarried Catholic, who's listening to you right now, what progress has been made in your view through this synod at this point?
Well, two things at least come to mind. One is to explore all possible ways of entering more deeply, sharing more deeply in the life of the Church. They're not excommunicated. Something Pope Francis said very clearly not that long ago, and was made very clear in the Synod too. They're not excommunicated. A lot of people think even because they're divorced, they've got no place in the life of the Church. Well, that's not true. But even if they're divorced and remarried, they're not excommunicated. So to explore ways, perhaps new ways, in which they can in fact share in the life of the Church, even though they don't necessarily share in communion. That's one option. The other option is the one that was proposed really by the German bishops, and that is what we call the internal forum. In other words, to sit down over time and engage in a process of discernment with a reliable spiritual guide. And in the light of what the Church teaches and in the light of what the Church's discipline is, to make a decision in conscience. Now, conscience was one of the very complex issues that became controversial through the Synod, as it always will. Yeah. It's not always easy to get the relationship between church teaching and conscience right, and it's often got wrong. Mm. I think in the end we've come up with a formulation that gives both church teaching its proper place, but also allows conscience to play its proper role. So there are possibilities of working towards a solution in what's called the internal forum. Mm-hmm. But that's not just personal preference. It's a serious spiritual journey that leads to a decision before God. There is some way forward. And it's not compromise. It doesn't put a bomb under church teaching about the indissolubility of marriage and all that stuff. But it's a realistic way of dealing with real situations in real people's lives.
So when you say internal forum, for those who may not be Catholics and may not know this, this refers to sitting down with a priest or a spiritual teacher or a bishop,
yeah,
and actually privately talking through these things and exploring privately in conscience but also with guidance where you might
That's
go.
Right.
That's what you mean.
See, and what it is, and what it recognises is that every story is unique. Again, this is where broad sweeping generalisations don't apply. Mm-hmm. Every one of these stories is unique, and it's that uniqueness before God that is explored before a decision is made in the sanctuary of conscience. But it's an intensely private process in one sense, because it's the believer before God, but accompanied by a spiritual guide who can keep an eye and an ear on the process of discernment as it unfolds.
So it's not just me and myself, but it's me and communing with the Church, in other words.
Precisely.
Talking to somebody.
Mm. It's an intensely private journey in one sense, but it's also a journey within the Church.
Can I ask you, in terms of synodality, this has been said over and over again, and you picked up on this. You said at another point in your blog, I think this synod is more directly linked to Vatican II than any other synod in the last 50 years. Now, that's a big claim. Why do you say that?
Because of the nature of the issues and the way in which they were addressed. It was a far more open and freer process, in that sense more challenging, than other synods have been, where there tended to be something more, as it were, orchestrated or controlled. That there was more a sense of the wildness of the Holy Spirit at work in this synod, and also because it was set within a journey. See, This synod was part of a journey that began in late 2013 when Pope Francis said we're going to have two synods.
Mm.
Then there was the preparation for last year's first synod. After that, there was the journey between that synod and this. And now we've had this synod and there's a journey beyond this. Now, that rhythm is also like the Second Vatican Council because a lot of the real action in the Second Vatican Council occurred between the sessions because there was a fermentation.
Yep. Discussion of ideas, so forth. Mm.
Precisely. It wasn't just at the sessions. It was between the sessions. And this synod, set within the context that Pope Francis gave, it had that same feel to it. And the other thing is, I think it was clear that the great underlying issues of the Second Vatican Council were also the great underlying issues of this synod. In other words, the relationship between faith and culture, the relationship between the Catholic Church and history, and inevitably that raises the extremely delicate question of the development of doctrine.
Mm.
So those were the great underlying issues of the Second Vatican Council, and more evidently than any other synod I can remember, they were and are the great underlying issues of this synod.
Can I ask you straight out, Paul VI and the Vatican Council wanted the Synod of Bishops, this one that you've just been to be a symbol of the collegiality, almost the decentralisation of the Church. There are those who would say up to now it's been pretty much a rubber stamp. Has this one been different?
It has been different. Paul VI really wanted to continue the trajectories, as it were, of the Second Vatican Council into the life of the Church beyond the Council. That was what really drove him to establish the Synod of Bishops. I think Pope Francis has led us to a much deeper understanding. Here I speak personally. He's led me to a much deeper understanding of synodality. The speech last Saturday morning was nothing if not programmatic. And what I came to see, and here he crystallised half thoughts and hunches that I'd had, I came to see his vision of the whole Church being synodal. In other words, synods aren't just an occasional feature of episcopal life, they are a permanent feature of the life of the whole Church.
And he means the whole Church talking, the whole Church consulting, to their bishops?
Well, not just talking. The first word he used was listening. He said primarily listening to the voice of the Holy Spirit, but listening to each other. So a synodal church is a listening church, and I think that is crucial, even though I tend to speak. But it does help to listen now and again. And again, I think Pope Francis has been a help to me personally on this. But within that context of a whole church which is on a journey together and listening together, he set what we call, in church speak, episcopal collegiality, you know, the bishops working together as part of a synodal church and in service of a synodal church. And then he finally spoke about the office of the Pope, the Petrine ministry, as we call it, the ministry of Peter in the church, that you can't understand the office of the Pope except within that context of the bishops working as collegially as possible within a church that is as synodal as possible. So in other words, you've got to have a listening church, at the heart of which there are listening bishops, and at the heart of the College of Bishops, as we say, there is a listening pope. And once you've listened, and only once you've listened, then you can speak, but a word that people might understand and listen to.
It seems that what the Pope's plan has been, this is just from the outside, reading your blog, reading all the reports I can, that he has been looking for a healthy way of decentralising the Church, making that more real.
I think that's true. And he used that very phrase, a healthy decentralisation. Now, there are people, and they tend to be rather vocal, who would say that there can be no such thing as a healthy decentralisation. Again, this is the all or nothing approach. It's the apocalyptic view. Either you have radical centralisation or total disintegration. I don't believe that. I think the kind of healthy decentralisation that Pope Francis is talking about, in fact, far from undermining the real unity of the Church, could strengthen it. It's paradoxical, but I think that's the way it works. See, he has said from the day he was elected Pope, I am not a monarch, and this is not the papal court. And in all kinds of ways, he puts a bomb under that understanding of a monarchical understanding of the Pope and the Pope as one who presides over a court. What he's after is a church that is both local and universal. If anything, I think for historical reasons, we have tended to be a little too centralised. Now, there can be very good things about that. And I'm the first to defend and promote the role of the Pope as the guardian of the Church's unity. I think it's an absolutely unique and precious part of the Catholic Church, and it's certainly a gift from God.
Mm.
But at the same time, that doesn't mean to say that bishops are the managers of branch offices, and that any talk of decentralisation is somehow the work of Satan. I don't believe that. So I think the Pope is quite determined to pursue the path of a healthy decentralisation, and he sees that as part of us becoming a synodal church. Well, listening to him last Saturday morning, one of the thoughts I had, and again it picks up on half thoughts and hunches that I've had before, is that it's probably time for us in Australia to look at having something like a national synod. Now, the bishops have talked about that, but I think what's happened here in Rome in the last 3 weeks and words spoken by the Pope might give us extra impetus to pursue that as an option.
In doing so, that would bring the 30-odd bishops of Australia together to
45.
Talk about 45 now.
Oh. Yeah, we're going up. Can never have too much of a good thing.
But it means they would come together to talk about Australia's specific needs.
They would,
pressures,
exactly.
As the Americans
exactly.
would. As the Germans
yeah.
would.
Yeah, that's right. And we would sit down and address the facts on the ground and try and find genuinely pastoral ways forward at a very complex time. And I think in the wake of the Royal Commission on Sexual Abuse, in the wake of this whole synodal process as it continues, I think it could fit very nicely into the life of the church in Australia. But we'll see on that.
You questioned at one point, and this is an interesting thing, the old Augustinian maxim, hate the sin, love the sinner. And you're on record talking to Josh McElwee from NCR saying that a personal say in certain cultures, you know, about sexuality, you were talking about that it's me, whereas in another culture they say it's just behaviour. Why is that important, do you think?
Well, again, I'm interested in it simply at the point of communication. It's been a venerable distinction that we've used for a very long time. The fact, and here I speak as one who taught for many years, has been a communicator. The fact is that now that distinction, not always, but often, and particularly in the area of sexuality, it just doesn't work in the sense it doesn't communicate. Because if I say, if I condemn the sin, particularly this sexual sin, as evil, I am automatically taken to be saying the person is evil. Because sexuality is not experienced as some... as one isolatable element in a person's life, it's fundamental to my sense of who I am, my identity.
And you say that in the West, precisely, don't you?
More particularly in the West. In the post-Freudian West, sexuality is, as it were, everywhere. And again, that's taken for granted in the culture. It's not just what you do. It becomes what you are. Now, once that's true, that distinction between sin and sinner, between what you do and what you are, it breaks down. So I'm not saying throw it out the window in every situation, but let's again face the fact that because there have been massive cultural and psychocultural changes, psychosocial changes in Western cultures, that these long-held distinctions do not communicate in the way that they might once have done. Therefore, we don't abandon what's being said, but we might have to look for other ways of communicating what we're trying to say, ways that people might understand and, who knows, might even accept.
Well, you mentioned one thing, for example. You mentioned the delicate area of suicide at one point, that new language has to be used.
That's not what I said. Mm. What I said was something's happened without anything being said.
Mm.
In fact, there's been no magisterial statement, but there's been, as it were, just... almost at an unconscious level, there's been a shift in our understanding of what might lead to suicide. I mean, it's an intensely complex and delicate area, as you say.
Mm.
But there's been no magisterial statement, but the church's practice has changed, and I say thank God. So that's one area where there's been a quite significant change.
By that we mean that previously the church forbade the burial of a suicide.
The church would not be buried from church or in consecrated ground.
Mm.
And that applied for centuries. Now, it's just changed. And I'd have to say probably in my lifetime it's changed. And no one said anything. No pope or bishop ever put out a decree. It just shifted because the culture shifted.
Mm.
And we came to a much more human and compassionate understanding, first of all, of what might lead to suicide, but then the effect, the devastating effect of suicide on any family. And Bishop Hurley, the other Australian bishop at the Synod, picked this up in his 3-minute speech to the Synod, told a very touching story of a man who'd been deeply alienated from and angry against the church because the priest refused to have the funeral of his son, who had taken his own life, from the church. So that's just a classic area where there has been quite significant shift in the way the church works or acts, but it hasn't violated any core teaching. Mm. It's just come from a deeper understanding of what's going on. In other words, getting in touch with the facts.
By way of sort of drawing this to a close, this is sort of an all-gambit question. I happen to be on social media just before I came to speak to you, and I happen to know the nephew of an Australian bishop who's gay. And he wrote on social media today, 3 weeks of intense discussion and church doctrine is unchanged. Marriage is permanent, homosexuality is unacceptable, divorced Catholics can't receive communion. No wonder the church is in decline, he said. I don't think he's right, is he?
No, I don't think he's right at all. I can understand that kind of reaction. But again, you have to live in the real world. I keep coming back to this. And the reality is there was never going to be any dramatic vote in favour of radical change on any of those points. But what there has been is a genuine step forward on a long and complex journey to try and deal with people in a way that respects the truth, that we claim we haven't concocted, we've received, respect that truth on the one hand, but at the same time, accompany people. Don't just hurl doctrine in their general direction. Mm. And that word accompaniment was, if there was any word that came to dominate the language of this synod, it was that. In other words, we've got to walk with people. Because if all we can do is hurl the truth at people from afar and not walk with them, then it's going to provoke exactly that reaction that you've reported as an equal and opposite reaction. Mm. So no, church teaching has not been touched at its heart, and it won't be. But that doesn't mean to say it's all or nothing. See, again, that reaction that you report gives voice to a kind of all or nothing approach. It's not all or nothing. It's exploring that difficult but crucial middle ground where we can walk together. We mightn't agree, but we can agree that we're human, and we can agree that we'll walk together, we'll listen to each other, we might even learn from each other, but we'll walk together to something better than just hurling whatever at each other.
Archbishop Mark Coleridge, the blogging Bishop of Brisbane, in Rome, at the Synod, about to celebrate the final Mass. Thank you very much for talking to Sunday Nights.
Thank you, Noel.